Well,
thank you.
I thank you for coming. I said in a sort of probably not true to my real spirit, I said to a couple of people on the boat, you know, why would you go up to a beautiful place like this and then talk about the Middle East? And I mean not in my spirit, because Carol and I lived in the Middle East for 3 years, and we've made many visits to the Middle East, and we love it. We love the Middle East. I mean, we just the other day were looking at a photo of a picnic we were having in Aleppo in a park in Syria, with our young son Jonah, who some of you heard play the ukulele the other night. He was a lot smaller then, so. I love the Middle East, and yet, you know, if we ask ourselves what images come into our minds when we say Middle East, obviously one of them probably are pages from Scripture, stories about Middle East in terms of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. The image I would start with today is the image of two squares, namely Tiananmen Square in China, and Tahrir Square in Cairo. Both squares that in recent years filled up with people, men and women, old and young, but I would guess a disproportionate number of young people saying, we want something different, we want something new, we want something better. And in both cases, the end or the middle, let's call it the middle part of the story, was disaster. Killing, murder, imprisonment, torture and silence. So taking that image, but also thinking of it not as the end of a story, but in a certain sense the beginning, which of course it isn't the beginning, because both cultures go back and back and back. Both have history, long histories. But it's somewhere in the middle of the story. And the story goes on, and those young people are growing. And they've learned, and they're learning, and they're some of them giving up and some of them not. So for me, that's a good way to begin the thing. And in your packet today, if you turn, well, first to the first page, the first thing is a historical benchmarks, and you see where they start, 1600 BC. So, you know, we're not talking about Europeans coming to the northern hemisphere here, to North America. We're talking about culture and history that goes back a ways. Anyway, you can look through that, and one of the things you'll no doubt see is there are times when the West also interacted with the Middle East. And we know something of that history. But I really look at the second page. It's an interesting... it's the only time I wasted money on a color copy. And what's interesting about it is that these are countries, most of them, that experienced some version of the Arab Spring. Beginning in 2011, you remember with the vendor who immolates himself after not only having his cart taken away by the government, but then being degraded and demeaned in a government office where he went to protest that his car had been taken away. And what the map shows is that in most of the countries where the Arab Spring erupted, or some version of it erupted, they are now once again autocratic regimes with a good amount of imprisonment and violence toward people who differ with the government. The only exception on there, well, there are three exceptions. Jordan, there are different kinds of exceptions. We'll come back to Saudi Arabia, but Jordan, where we live, where a monarchy has survived and adjusted or adapted itself to modernity in a way over decades that have proven that the society can hold together, more or less. Although right now Jordan is incredibly burdened by a number of refugees that make, you know, refugees that we're talking about not absorbing seem like a drop in the bucket. And then Lebanon, which also has its own special story of how it survived. Democracy, yes, no, different factions, yes, no, but at least not a dictatorship, not an autocratic regime in the sense that today Egypt is, that Saudi Arabia is, that Libya is, and it's a wild scene, Algeria. So Tunisia is an exception. I just briefly say, because we're not going to pay much attention to it, but it's worth following on the news, because Tunisia had a history of civil society organizations and unions before the breakdown of the autocracy, before the Arab Spring. And that became very important because there was a network of organizations that were used to the idea that part of their role was to help make change. And so when the Arab Spring erupted, there were paths in which the Arab Spring popular uprising could go. There were organizations that could help lead it, guide it, negotiate for it, for its future. But it's not an easy path. I mean, right now there's a fair amount of turmoil in Tunisia. But it's not Syria. It's not Syria in the sense of a whole broken down society, or Libya, not Libya. It's quite different and quite still more hopeful. It's also a society where the Muslim Brotherhood oriented people and the secular liberal people found a way to accommodate each other, which is, man, that's important. That's important. So what I thought we'd do for the first part of today is look at five countries, and they're the ones on the front page, and simply try to hear if I wrote some questions for myself that I would ask about each of them, a question I'd ask about each of them, but I thought probably you would have a question. Who has a question about Egypt today? And if you do, just, I mean, there are no great questions or poor questions, just questions. I mean, if no one raises their hand, I'll tell you the question that I asked myself. What I asked is, why did the Arab Spring fail? Simple, huh? I mean, there was that picture in Tahrir Square, and how many of you have been in Egypt? Okay, so you've been to that square, probably. It's a huge square in the middle of Cairo. And it was filled to the overflowing with people saying, we want democracy, we want something new, we want justice, we want Mubarak to go, President Mubarak to go. And then, and this is a very important thing, and I refer to it in regard to Tunisia. In Egypt, up until then, and still largely today, there were two parts of the society that were organized sufficiently to run the country. One was the military. And they had run the country for years. And I don't mean just the government, but the economy also. The military ran big chunks of the economy. And the second group that was strong enough in terms of its numbers of supporters and organized enough to run the country was the Muslim Brotherhood, exactly, which itself had gone through changes since its founding in the 20s, to where both as a way of keeping itself alive and keeping its leaders alive, and as a decision out of a certain maturing wisdom about how to make change, had changed from believing that violence was essential to making change to where violence was probably not a good idea. Not a pacifist position by any means, but a practical strategic decision by the Brotherhood to follow a political path, not a violent path. So you had these two forces, but did that represent all of Egypt? If you went to Tahrir Square on the days when people were in the streets, you would find a lot of people that were neither military nor Muslim Brotherhood, even though most of them were Muslims, since 90% of Egyptians are Muslims, but they were Muslims who didn't identify with the Brotherhood. If you want to call them more liberal Muslims, Muslims who would work easily with secularists and even with Egyptian Christians, the Copts. And so you had these three large groupings, the military, Muslim Brotherhood, and the sort of collection of people, but not with an organization, not with a political platform, not with a clear, coherent strategy. And what you had happen was when they got rid of that collection of the Brotherhood and the secular liberals on the streets, the military recognized that now, this is an artificial number, but that 2/3 of Egypt was against them. And they had to give up power. And so some of the people in the military said, okay, Mubarak, it's time to go. And Mubarak eventually went. The U.S. gave a little bit of a nudge, but it was basically the realities in Egypt. Then what do you got? Well, then you have the possibility of an election. And in the election, who of the two forces, now leaving the military aside, had the capacity to win an election? Well, the one that was organized, the Muslim Brotherhood. And so Egypt has a Muslim Brotherhood president, President Morsi. But you know, one of the characteristics of movements is they think they're more than they are. They think they're more than they are. And you know, I think this is true of movements here and there and everywhere. There's a certain movement ego that takes over. And we are Egypt. Of course, Morsi and the Brotherhood was not Egypt. It was part of Egypt, a very serious, important part, but it certainly wasn't Egypt. And they, to put it in an odd way about Muslims, they overplayed their hand. They overplayed their hand. They went for changes that secular liberal Muslims and others wouldn't abide. And so all of a sudden, you have, not all of a sudden, but over months, you had the beginning of a clash between these two groups, which if they hadn't cooperated, never could have gotten rid of the military control, but they began to be at odds with each other. And as you know, that then led to what? The military having a new capacity, a different capacity. Whereas the military, when these two forces, secular liberal and Muslim Brotherhood, were united, the military had to sort of say, well, we've got to change here some, and Mubarak, you need to go. But when the two forces were divided, then the military could intervene in a way that followed its own interests. And where did it lead? It led back to military autocratic rule. And that's what Egypt has now, at a tremendous cost. Tremendous cost, because, you know, hopes raised and then dashed are costly on the human spirit and on a country that goes through it. And so that's what you had in Egypt, and costly because the military, once it got back in power, partly with the help of the secular liberals who didn't want the military back in power but were getting increasingly nervous about the Brotherhood's power, once they're back in power, they go after the other force that has the capacity to rule Egypt, namely the Brotherhood. And so the number of arrests, the number of imprisonments, the number of killings by the military of Muslim Brotherhood leadership is extensive and ongoing. And of course, to the extent that secular liberals didn't want the military to come back and began to stand up against the military alongside the Muslim Brotherhood, they too suffered. So there are now 40,000 to 50,000 political prisoners in Egypt. But it's not the end of the story, because people are involved. So it's not the end of the story. All right, let's leave it. I mean, you know, we're going to leave things, to say the least, inconclusively. And probably that's as important as anything else I say, that it's inconclusive. And so there's room for more understanding, more reading, more thinking, more talking about that. So let's turn to Syria. Carol and I took us almost a year before we started visiting Syria when we lived in Amman, and we realized when we went that Syria is a lot more important country than we realized, and part of the reason we didn't get it was because Syria, of all the countries in the Middle East, from a U.S. perspective, was behind the Iron Curtain. That is to say, it had Russia as an ally, first the Soviet Union, then Russia. And so, of course, we here thought that's all you needed to know about Syria, right? That it was allied with Russia or had Soviet Union as an ally. You don't need to know anything else about it. You don't need to know any of its history or culture, da-da-da. You know, that was enough. And so I think we were blinded as sort of typical Americans in the sense we were, and we didn't get there. And when we got there, oh my God, Syria is so important, so interesting, because it's a country on the one hand run somewhat like Yugoslavia by a very strong man with a party that he comes from, in the case of Syria, the Ba'ath Party, and runs the country tightly, in certain ways, that is to say, you do not say when you're in Damascus, I think Assad is wrong. And we learned that early on, and we were cautioned about it. It didn't take much to be convinced. But it's, on the other hand, it's a society where if you go out to dinner or talk, people are talking about politics and philosophy and intellectual life and the art, life of the arts is incredibly strong in Damascus. And interesting, vital. It's a country like Yugoslavia in the sense there are many parts of it, pieces of it, that partly get along because people are inclined to get along, mostly. And partly because there was a strong Ba'ath Party leader that held things together. And you know, Yugoslavia is a story like that. Yugoslavia under Tito was by no means some nirvana. On the other hand, it held together. And as his leadership passed into the night, it had trouble holding together. So where are we in Syria? The question I have for myself, will the war there ever end? Because it seems like it might not. And of course, it's been tragic beyond anything, almost anything we've experienced in this part of the 21st century. I mean, things that have happened in Libya and Sudan and Yemen are catching up, to say a funny way to put it. Terrible things, but Syria has been, I mean, you know, 400 to 500,000 people dead, Syrians. 2 million, 3 million, yes, go ahead.
You asked if we had questions.
Sure, yes.
Well, what drives Assad to do all this awful stuff? What does he have any positive vision or something?
He believes he and the Ba'ath Party that he heads is essential to hold Syria together. That's what he believes. I mean, now you can say that's not necessarily positive, but I think he sees it as positive. And people around him, loyal to him, also see that as positive and see the threats to Syria holding together under Assad to be numerous. Numerous in the sense that it's not just now it's ISIS, but the reform movement. The reform movement which broke out in the part of Syria next to Jordan in a place called Dera, D-E-R-A-A, was threatening and the regime didn't know how to deal with reformist protests. Although interestingly, and this is a sad footnote on it all, in our last visits to Damascus, which when I was taking interfaith groups around and one of the places we'd go in Damascus, people we knew, including prominent business people in Damascus, were hopeful that the younger Assad understood, well, even that the senior Assad understood and that the younger Assad had begun to adapt a certain sense of how to have to modernize Syria, which included, for example, the simple thing of opening the internet. And younger Assad did that, opened the internet. Well, you know, that's a dangerous thing. I mean, there are, in terms of autocratic rule, internet can be a dangerous thing, and in some sense it was. But he decided to do that. He and his advisors decided to do that. And if that parting was, how do you keep control and accommodate change? He also, apparently, younger Assad was following his father's footsteps. He was interested in a peace settlement with Israel. Now, you may, given Assad's image today, you say, oh, you're kidding me. But Senator Mitchell, George Mitchell, who I have the best, highest regard for, and Senator Kerry, when he was Senator Kerry, this is early in the Obama administration, traveled to Damascus and came back reporting that it seemed clear that younger Assad was interested in moving on a peace agreement with Israel. Something they did not pursue because they got all wrapped up in the Palestinian-Israeli thing, which is a lot to get wrapped up in, as you can imagine. So, one of the pieces of the history of the war that, I mean, we are so quick to forget, and partly we forget what we don't even see in the first place. So it's easy to forget it. Two of the most seasoned, respected international diplomats that are alive today worked on trying to end the war in Syria. One was the former Secretary General of the United Nations, whose name is slipping me, Kofi Annan, right, Kofi Annan. The second was an Algerian by the name of Ibrahim.
Oh boy.
Ibrahim is his last name. He's Algerian. These were two men that you ask any international diplomats, and they said, these are two of the best. And one after the other, they worked on the idea of a conference that would move to get a ceasefire and a transitional government leading to a new inclusive government in Syria. Where the implication in the process was that Assad probably would go, but they were smart enough, like we're not, to not call for it in advance. Because you don't get Assad to come to a conference to end the war if you're insisting that he's got to go in advance. I mean, it's just like, yeah, right, you know. But in 2014, Ban Ki-moon, then Secretary General of the UN, based on the work these diplomats had done, issued invitations to all the parties to come to the conference in Geneva. The U.S., number one, insisted that part of the conference preparation be based on the idea that Assad would go. Kept insisting on this at that time. We've since backed away from that zone. The other thing we said, Iran cannot be at the conference. And Ban Ki-moon had issued an invitation to Iran. Now, at the same time we said Iran can't be at the conference, we were saying that Iran's in there meddling. It's meddling. It's doing stuff. It was supporting Assad and had. Forces that it was supporting, Assad. But, you know, if you're going to end a war, you probably have to end it with the people who are making it. But we said no, and, I mean, this is one of the things, when I read this, I got so angry. We insisted that Ban Ki-moon withdraw his invitation to Iran. That's 2014, half, at that point, 200,000 dead, and half the number of refugees. Since then, double the number of dead, and at least double the number of refugees. So will the war ever end? If it's going to end, it's going to end some way like that. Messy. Are the Russians still going to be there supporting a Syrian government? Probably so. I mean, you know, is Israel going to change and the U.S. not be supporting an Israeli government? I mean, you know, come on. In other words, this is the one place in the Middle East where Russia has a foothold, has a small base at Latakia, a naval base. Well, they're not going to give that up easily. You just accept that. So the idea that we're somehow going to get the Russians out. Anyway, so if it's going to end, it's going to end in that sort of a process. And, you know, I'll give away a thing that I'm going to say that you... If you all walk out after I say it, I will understand. When Trump in his campaign said, wouldn't it be good if the U.S. could cooperate with Russia? I said yes. I think I probably can't stand Trump as much as any of the rest of you. But when he said that, I said, yeah. That's not a bad idea. And probably Hillary would never say that way, you know. He said it in this sort of simplistic, childlike, naive way, but he said it. Wouldn't it be good if the U.S. could cooperate with Russia? And I said, yes. And you know, by the way, that he and Putin are meeting this coming week on the side of the G20 meeting. That's happening in Europe. I forget what city. But the G20 is meeting, and Putin and Russia and Trump are going to meet. I've got an article which you can pick up on your way out, which, you know, asks the question. And by the way, another of my favorite characters, particularly from the Vietnam era, Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger met with Putin last week. And wrote an article several months ago in which he criticized the U.S. role in the Ukraine as being too Cold War-ish and not sensible. See, Henry Kissinger, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Henry Kissinger is smart enough, and I've never thought he was dumb. I thought he was evil, but never dumb. And he was smart enough to shed his anti-Russia stuff because it was a new world situation, and you had to figure out how to move in it in a new context in which Cold War, being locked in on the Cold War was not enough. So he wrote an article about Ukraine and some of the ways that both Russia and the United States fell into Cold War patterns in Ukraine that really weren't helpful to anybody. So Henry is out there with Putin. Now Trump's going to be with Putin. Oh my God, you know. Do we have to, are we prepared to, even in our wildest imagination, say, well, maybe that meeting was a good thing. Ooh-hoo. I mean, I worry about us because I think Trump has given us so much to be totally opposed to that it's hard to be rational.
Let's pray about it.
Well, it sure would help. It sure would help. And part of the prayer has to be, Lord, help me to know that I don't know enough yet. And that I might be surprised. So that's a word about Syria. Saudi Arabia. The question I posed to myself was, is there any way to view Saudi Arabia not simply as either an ally with whom we go to bed all the time, or totally evil, who we should want to get rid of? And those are options, because the evil side, of course, is the Wahhabism, the kind of fundamentalist Islamic extremist stuff that comes out of Saudi Arabia in various ways that was responsible for the fact that many of the terrorists who attacked the United States had come from Saudi Arabia. They grew up in that culture. They grew up. Now, they weren't sent by the Saudi government, although there are some links there that are a bit troubling with some pieces of the Saudi government. So that the evil part, and there was a conference at University of Washington where this was the theme, Saudi Arabia, the evil, 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 evil. Yeah. And then, of course, the other side, ally, goes back to the end of World War II and oil. And you know, we needed them then. We need them less now. And by the way, they know that. They do know that, and they also know that their oil prices are going down and that climate change is not limited to its effects on the United States, you know. And so they're worried, and you may have read just recently they've gone through a rather odd transition to the new leader, where one new leader, who was in line by birth, has been pushed aside, and the younger one, who's been edging for this for several years, is now lifted up to be the next leader. And he's an interesting character, not either totally evil, nor would you want to be totally aligned with him, because on domestic stuff, he's interesting. He sees the need, to put it in a simple, symbolic way, for women to be able to drive. But I don't mean it that way. He sees that women, for instance, there are more women, a higher percentage of women enrolled in Saudi universities than men. Right now, that's true. He sees what that's about. I mean, it's about a kind of change that there's no way that any society can finally resist it. So he's interesting in that respect. He's interesting in respect to liberalizing the society in terms of internet and maybe not protest, but at least maybe a column occasionally in a paper that says something different. Now, on foreign policy, he's strongly anti-Iran, and he's all for the war in Yemen, where Iran and Saudi Arabia and its sort of clients are at each other and destroying Yemen and by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. So how do you maneuver in that? And of course, one of the things about Saudi Arabia we know from the recent Trump trip is that we love to sell arms, $110 billion worth of arms over 10 years. And what does that get us? And what does that mean? Well, you know, that is not a Trump position. That's been a position of American foreign policy for decades. That selling arms in Saudi Arabia is more important than human rights in Saudi Arabia. No way around that. As much as I love Obama, Obama did it, the Bushes did it, Clinton did it, everybody does it. Partly because there's big money involved and big companies, and living in Washington State, we know at least one of them. So, how do you view, and then, of course, you can say, well, we shouldn't sell arms to Saudi Arabia. There was a little bit of a bark in that direction by President Obama's administration at one point, and immediately the Russian foreign minister was visiting in Saudi Arabia. So, you know, it's not just our wanting to sell arms, there are others. And of course, one of the advantages we have in having sold them arms so long is probably theirs don't fit ours. You know what I mean? I mean, the problem of parts. So we got our, quote, as a Quaker I knew used to say, we've got a leg up on that deal. Saudi Arabia.
Ron, how does a question?
Yeah, sure. Yes, go.
Yeah, to your point on tourism, I heard the comparison that I thought was interesting, that establishing a center to combat terrorism,
yes.
Center to combat terrorism in Riyadh is roughly the equivalent of establishing a center to combat anti-Semitism in the middle of Nazi Germany.
You mean by the German government?
For example.
Well, I mean, you'd have to say about German government. Yeah, yeah. No, I think, look, it's... The other side of that is that the regimes there are themselves targets of terrorism. Because the Daesh, ISIS phenomena, they see all those regimes as corrupt as hell. They're not Islamic regimes, they're corrupt regimes, and they want them to go. So there have been terrorist attacks against Saudi Arabia, maybe sometimes even by citizens of Saudi Arabia. But certainly people who have been trained in some of the fundamentalist, extremist thinking that one associates with a major trend of religious thinking in Saudi Arabia. So it's a little complicated. I mean, I think one of the ironies is that certainly Iran, though on the one hand supporting terrorism in certain venues, namely the Syrian venue, Lebanon, Hezbollah, and Hamas, is also very nervous about terrorism. As you've seen, there have been terrorist attacks in Iran. So one would think that the combating terrorist center would be at across the bridge of Iran and Saudi Arabia, but it's not right now. So it's complicated. Certainly, I think anybody, and this will come out when we deal with Daesh in the last half hour or so, anybody who's serious about terrorism does want our countries and governments to take on part of the role. Now, what's the role? You know, is it 90% military and 10% a variety of other things? Is it 90% something else and 10% military? That's a whole big argument. And right now, the Combating Terrorism Center seems to be oriented on the military side, although they're also aware that anti-extremist propaganda is important. So they've got to put out their line on what the true Islam is. Now we come to Iraq, which in one sense is probably easy in our grouping here, which is, you know, I mean, there's hardly a politician now who doesn't say that the war was wrong, the invasion was wrong in 2003, George W. Bush invasion and occupation. There's hardly a politician. Some of them are even making up that they said it back then. You know, and it turns out that both candidates in this presidential election could be accused of that, making it up a little bit that they said it back then. So, Iraq, the invasion and occupation, some people, Madeleine Albright, who's not known for her radicalism, calls it the most disastrous foreign policy mistake in U.S. history. Without the invasion and occupation of Iraq, there would not be an ISIS. But that leads to the second piece of what has been wrong since we invaded Iraq with what we've been doing. Well, what we did, of course, when we invaded, which there were some, besides saying, don't do this, who said, you know, when you do this, don't get rid of the whole government and army. That is to say, a society that, in some sense, like Syria, is held together by an army and a government, you don't just get rid of it all. But that's what we did, effectively. We got rid of the whole army, or the core of the officers, and didn't kill them, but pushed them out of power. Well, of course, the people that welcomed that were the people in Iraq, the Iraqis, mostly Shiites, who had been under the thumb of that government and that army for years. So they welcomed this, and guess what other country welcomed it? A neighbor of Iraq? Iran, of course, Iran. So then what comes in with our sort of acquiescence, although maybe we couldn't prevent it either, what we could have prevented is that the dissolution of the army and the government. That was a big, big mistake. after the biggest mistake, which was going in the first place. So what did we do? Well, we acquiesced in the formation of a government by the name, headed by a man named al-Maliki, a Shiite, with strong Iranian support, who then proceeded to call the other members of the government, because there was to be a Sunni vice president and a Kurdish vice president. He labeled them as terrorists and threatened their lives, and they fled. Well, there goes the chance of a sort of umbrella unifying government in Iraq. And interestingly, Iran saw that as a problem too. We saw it as a problem, they saw it as a problem, and Iran and the U.S. cooperated quietly, wouldn't want this to get out, cooperated in getting rid of al-Maliki and bringing in a new head of the Iraqi government, a man named al-Abadi. Al-Abadi committed himself to try to bring more inclusivity in the government. But it ain't easy. Once you get things going in a certain direction, that's hard to stop. And then you have the people who feel they've been totally pushed out, which is largely Sunni Iraqis. They start leaning toward some kind of resistance to the government of in Baghdad. So you get al-Qaeda and you have ISIS. So here, what, I mean, I'm not even going to try to answer the question except to say that what Iraq needs is a government that has a capacity to, or is seen as, a government that is seen as somehow representing vast majority of Iraqis, which obviously he has to include Sunnis as well as Shiites. And so far, that has not happened. And until that happens, number one, the chances of it quieting down in Iraq, even if the military is able to win battles in Mosul and so forth, is a risky business that it's gonna end the troubles. The other thing that has to happen, and this will come to this again in the last half hour, is in the areas where the government has taken back power from the ISIS formations, there is a need for an infusion of government funding and business funding to rebuild these areas, which are, of course, largely Sunni areas. To the extent that that happens, that helps Sunni Iraqis to believe, or at least to imagine, that the government may not be totally against them. Simple matter, but big bucks, and not military. The easy thing to do is to add 4,000 troops, you know, or 400 troops. The harder thing to do is something that involves large amounts, infusions of funds, of redevelopment funds, funds to rebuild in areas that have been taken over by ISIS, much destruction in that process, and then taken back by the Iraqi military and much destruction in that process. So just take Mosul. You've been reading and watching on television what's going on in Mosul. Well, what's going to happen after Mosul? ISIS is out of Mosul. Big question. But there's going to be a hell of a lot of rebuilding. Never mind centuries-old mosques, houses, schools. And that's going to take money. And there's some doubt about whether the international community, the United States, that's ready to send troops and advisors, is ready to do anything like that. So there's Iraq. And then Iran and...
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
With Iraq, the Kurds.
Yes.
Could you touch on the people group of the Kurds?
Yeah. I mean, we're learning more about them too late, too little. But, I mean, I say we're learning more about them because, for instance, in Syria, you've probably been reading the complication for the Turkish government, who wants to get rid of ISIS, but doesn't particularly like the idea of getting rid of ISIS by the Kurds, because the Kurds then are gaining control and territory and strength in fighting, that they're connected with the Kurds that live in Turkey, who are not happy in Turkey, want something different. And there's then debate about autonomy, Kurdish state, and all that. But anyway, there's certainly a, quote, threat to the current Turkish government. So you got that complication. Well, you got the same situation in Mosul. And it's different because, well, wherever Kurds are on both sides of the Turkish border and whatever's next door, it becomes problematic because they know each other, they're family. And they don't like the Turkish government, and the Turkish government recently has made itself even more unlikable in the sort of consolidation of power that's gone on in the capital. So, and you know, I say we're learning too little too late. I mean, the Kurds have been around for a long time. And you know, Kurds in Syria, I mean, that's one of the elements that Assad managed, Papa Assad, Hafez al-Assad, managed to hold the thing together, despite Kurdish instincts toward more autonomy. Yes, ma'am.
What country did Kurds come from? They just appear all over the place.
Well, they appear all over the place because they've never been able to be comfortable or left alone where they are. I mean, in that sense, they're very much like Jews, you know? that's why Jews turn up all over, or Palestinians turn up all over the world.
That's
correct. Armenians, of course, are Christians. Kurds are a variety of Muslim. Yes. And they live in the area, predominantly in the area of Turkey, Iraq, and Syria. And those borders, of course, were not, you know, God-given. They were colonial-given. And oftentimes, colonialists didn't necessarily have the best interest of anybody except the colonialists in mind. So when they made the borders, they didn't take account of, well, where do the Kurds fit in this? You know?
Have they been a nomadic people?
I can't tell you that. I don't know. What you're asking really is, what's their history going back? And I'm sorry, I just don't know. I say Google because don't we Google everything? I mean, I certainly do. I just put a question. I say, were the Kurds ever nomadic people? And usually Google comes up and says something. And I more or less assume that it's correct, but that's not necessarily true. So Iran, just to finish off the five countries, ha ha ha. Iran, you know, Iran is an extraordinary country. Carol and I go back and forth about where else do we want to go. I know that I want to go to Iran. It's an extraordinary country. Its history is extraordinary. You know, Persia. I mean, some people, in fact, there are Iranian Americans who like to say, I'm Persian.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Partly because of the Iran and the revolution and all that, and our some biases we have here, or many biases we have here. But Iran, one of the things, okay, we'll stop in a minute. I don't know, you know, I'm 74, I know I need bathroom breaks, but let's stop right after the Iran thing. The one thing I want to make clear that I believe very much about Iran is that one of the most important achievements of the Obama administration was the Iran nuclear deal. And it was important for a number of reasons. Number one, the U.S. didn't do it alone. It did it with what's called the P5, which means the five members of the UN Security Council. I assume we know that. Which means Russia and China are involved, are in that. And Germany, because of Germany being a very powerful European country. So, number one, we didn't do it by ourselves. Number two, it has postponed the advent of another nuclear weapon power in the world. In that sense, it's the most successful non-proliferation agreement that has been achieved. It's also important because it opened at least possibility. Obama said this. It opens new future possibilities. Now, there are all kinds of people around him trying to shut down any new possibilities with Iran. But I think he was right in the sense that once you negotiate with a government, Iran, and you make this kind of a step and they get something out of it, relaxation of sanctions. You know, it wasn't, we didn't give them money. We didn't give them any money. We were holding money. Money was being held as a form of sanction that when they signed the deal, those sanctions were relaxed and they got their money back. And politicians all the time were getting away with it. We gave them so many billion dollars. And this is bull. It was, you know, that was fake news, you know. But it was important because it opened possibilities, just as U.S. recognizing Cuba. The question I had down about Iran was, what did our years of not dealing with Iran from 1979 to the present, what did it accomplish? Not a damn thing is the answer, I think. I would challenge anyone to say that it made Iran a better place, it made the world safer. In fact, one of the things that it did, which is very dangerous, and we're seeing the dangers of it today, is it allowed Saudi Arabia to think that we would never deal with Iran. And so Saudi Arabia didn't have to deal with Iran. Imagine if we had had diplomatic relations since 1970 with Iran, or say since 84, because we had to get over the hostage crisis. Certainly there was a sort of lump in our throat about that, of course, and understandably. So you wouldn't rush to have relations, but we develop relations. What if we had developed relations? What do you think the Saudis would? But they begin to think, you know. They're not dumb. Well, the U.S. is having relations with Iran, just as the Europeans began to have relations with Iran. We've got to adjust a little bit, rather than treat them as sort of this outlaw regime. So we've now, you know, we've now cleared up everything about five countries. And I suggest maybe we take a 5-minute break, and then what I'd like to do is talk about ISIS and at least go through these 11 points, 10 or 11 points about how do you deal with ISIS. And I mean, that's a pretty good morning's work on the Middle East, I think. So anybody needs to go to the bathroom or anything else? Well, let's say 5 minutes.
Good. About the Shiites and the
Sunnis. Yes.
And like, how do you compare? First of all, like, I think about the Christians having disagreements, the Hundred Years' War, the Reformation.
Yeah.
How can you explain a little bit more about them? And also,
give
me some idea, is there a way in which they could reconcile?
Well, I'll say it briefly in this way. In most cases, the Sunni-Shiite divide is not, first of all, a religious divide. It's a divide over economic and political power. So the fact that it was a Sunni regime in Baghdad and Shiites were oppressed, got very much the short end of the stick, was the issue, not the theological differences between Sunni and Shiite. That's an overlay. It's an overlay. It's a neat way to say, oh, that's the problem, but that's not the problem. In Lebanon, when the French left, they left the Christians in charge, and the Sunnis next in charge, and the Shiites at the bottom. Well, guess what? The Shiites were terribly dissatisfied with that arrangement and began to form political opposition, then very much stimulated by the Israeli invasion of 1982, where the Shiites took it in the ear because they lived in the south of Lebanon, near the Israeli border. So when the Israelis came through, they came through the Shiites. The Shiites, by the way, also were quite ticked off at the PLO because the PLO had been raiding Israel from southern Lebanon. But the division in Lebanon was not fundamentally a theological difference. There are differences. For instance, Shiites tend to allow a kind of respect for and celebration of other people in Islamic history. And that borders on the crown sin in Islam, which is one God, one to be worshipped. So when they go, for instance, Shiites might go to a grave site, the Sunnis say, see, they're worshipping. And there are those differences, as there were differences between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. But the real difference was political and economic power. That's what the fight was about. And I think in most of the cases you would look at in the Middle East, you would say that. The other thing to say about reconciliation is that there were loads of Shiite Sunni weddings in Iraq. Iraqis who were Sunni marrying Iraqis who were Shiites and having children. And today, in fact, there's a getting stronger trend among many Muslims not to identify themselves any longer as Shiite or Sunni, but as Muslims. Our own son, our younger son, not the youth playing guy, but our younger son who became a Muslim 6 years ago, and that's how we wound up with Omar as our grandson. He for a number of years, ever since he first became a Muslim, picked up on this idea, I'm not a Sunni, I'm not a Shiite. The one thing I wanted to mention that is in the background packet and worth not only reading there, but you can easily find it online, is to read what are called the Arab Human Development Reports, because they
first of all, are done by Arabs from different Arab countries for the United Nations, and their reports on the problems in Arab societies of lack of democracy, lack of economic justice, and these issues, lack of openness to different currents of thought, these issues, until and unless they're addressed in serious ways, ISIS will be there and grow in various ways. Because that's what it feeds on. It feeds on basic discontents in the society. And those discontents are usually even more profound among young people, because young people have hopes of a good life, and when they run up against no jobs, or no jobs that match their education level, they get an education, but then their jobs don't match their education. That's a very frustrating experience. So definitely look at the Arab Human Development Reports. And by the way, that started back in, I think, 2002. Subsequently, they've done specific reports on the issue of youth, on women. So you look at those two. And the reason I included the last, next to the last thing in your packet is, you'll find it, because there's a picture of a young Arab man. And he's such a, to me, just looking at his picture, you like him right away. You like him, or at least I found myself liking him. He's probably somewhat educated, I mean, maybe even college. And he's looking out in this refugee camp, you know, what happens to young people like that? Where do they go? What do they do? And this is a problem in all of the societies that we've been talking about.
Including America.
Well, you know, that's one of the things, and by the way, one of the things, I'm glad you said that, because, I mean, any of us today who can still feel smug about our society compared to anybody else's, better take another look. Better take another look. You know, and it's not to then denigrate us or our country. It's to just be honest. Just to be honest. I mean, one of the things that I've said to people is, we are schizophrenic. How can a society produce George W. Bush, president, Barack Obama, president, Donald Trump, president? Huh? Is that the same country? Is that the same country? Well, by the way, it happens in Israel, too. It happened in Iran. You remember? I don't know if you know the name Khatami. Khatami was the elected president before Ahmadinejad. And Ahmadinejad was horrible, horrible. Now, he had a certain base. He had his base. Interestingly, poor Iranians. And now we've got Rouhani. Well, how is that the same country? Well, it turns out it is. Just as ours is the same country. Let's look at the last page in fact, the back of the last page, and just run down these ideas. By the way, I confess in this choice of these, I was very moved when I read them, and I actually read them before I realized they were written by a person that Carol and I know very well. His name is, and this is, it's a fascinating little story, because Ambassador Daniel Kurtzer, he's the first Jew to be appointed ambassador in Egypt for the United States and then to Israel.
Wow.
And his politics about Israel are terrific. You'll hear that tomorrow. That is to say, he's not stupid enough to think that what Israel's doing is good for Israel. He's not stupid enough. And he's Jewish, which makes it a lovely, you know, story. So you can, I can go to a synagogue and say, you know, I have a chance to get Ambassador Kurtzer to come speak here. And if the rabbi knows the ambassador, he said, well, that's great. Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, because what he's going to come and say is not going to put up with the bull about support Israel right or wrong. Just that's not him. Well, he's the guy that wrote these pieces, although he also drew on General John Allen. And I, coming out of the Southern Movement and Martin Luther King and nonviolence and so forth, I'm always a little embarrassed when I say, this general was really smart. But this general is really smart, John Allen. He, for instance, came up with the idea that maybe we needed a Marshall Plan in the Middle East. It's not a good idea, because Marshall Plan in Europe was rebuilding societies that already had a basis of democracy and good business practice and so forth. The Arab countries don't. So it's not quite, the analogy Marshall Plan isn't quite right. But where he's right is, that what's needed is huge efforts at development and democratization, not militarization. That's where he's writing. That's General Allen. So here's Kurtzer. And first of all, the first point is treat Daesh, ISIS, as a regional issue. It isn't something that just grows out of the soil of one particular country. And that's important. So you treat it as a regional issue. Second, empower indigenous forces to struggle against it, because its struggles on the ground about it and against it are absolutely essential, so that our sending, you know, I don't disrespect what our special forces can do on occasion by going in and killing somebody who's an important leader. I happen not to agree with it, but I don't disrespect it. I mean, I know they've got talents, I know they've got guts, I know they've got brains, they're trying to do something that is trying to be helpful. But what he's saying here is, unless indigenous forces are involved in opposing ISIS, it's a no-win battle.
Excuse me.
Yep.
Just does anyone need a chance to put their name on the list to get it?
Okay. Yeah. Just.
I think if it hasn't been around, then we need to.
Okay. Good for you.
Whoever has.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Next one is deny ISIS ability to operate within territory. Well, that's going on. That's happening right now in Raqqa and Mosul. And obviously, and we'll come to it as we go down the list, the question is not just how you get them to give up territory, but what you do in the territory when they give it up. And that's at least as challenging as getting them to give up the territory. Target leadership. Well, there's where I talk about special forces. I've always been a pacifist that knows that I don't have all the answers. And sometimes it appears as if somebody who's not a pacifist may have part of the answer, you know? I mean, I know that the man, I worked for Jim Lawson for 2.5 years in Memphis. Jim Lawson, you may know his name in the civil rights context. And I think he'd kick me in the ass if he heard me say that. But I also teased him when his 4-year-old picked up a baseball bat and turned it into a rifle, you know? So nonviolence is absolutely essential as an operating principle and something to hold on to. And it partly because if you hold on to nonviolence, you at least ask the question, isn't there some other thing we could do besides bump this guy off? At least that. But I'm willing to be a little bit modest about I don't have all the answers. Intensify information warfare. Obviously a big thing. This is partly, hopefully, what this Center for Combating Terrorism is going to do. It's certainly something the Muslim community itself is doing, and doing far more than they get credit for. How often do you hear something like, well, you know, Muslims should speak out against this? Well, they're speaking out all the time, they just don't get coverage. And I can document that in terms of major Muslim organizations here in this country and other places who continuously speak out against terrorism and work hard against it. Hit at Daesh's financial base. That's very important. In other words, where Daesh has gotten territory which includes oil wells, there's a simple example, you go after the oil wells because that's providing financial support to ISIS. Or if there's a route through which money is flowing to ISIS, you block those routes. He makes a point about the Turkish border being a problem in that respect, that there is money flowing through the Turkish, or across the Turkish border into Syria and Iraq, that's going to ISIS, and that should be stopped. Well, that's an interesting story. What's going on in the Turkish government about that? Yeah, this next one, very important. When we talked about Iraq and the Sunni areas that were devastated first by the war, then devastated by ISIS, then devastated by the Iraqi government getting rid of ISIS, create and fund a serious stabilization and, I would say, reconstruction fund, particularly for Iraq. These areas are terribly important because people have lost immense of their living capacity, both in terms of business and schools and homes. And for, as I say, first, it's important for us to remember that our invasion did it. Then, second, ISIS did it as it took territory in those areas. And third, the Iraqi government, which took back the territory, did it. So 3 times these areas have been hit. And you've seen pictures on television of Mosul or Raqqa, and you say, my God, what's going to happen next? Well, big question. And what he's saying is there has to be funding for redevelopment in these areas. Intensify social media and public information campaigns, okay, to impact recruitment. And this is something that, particularly with young people, that there's going on, this is going on in the Muslim world, it's going on from here, and it's something that needs to be intensified. Keep plugging away at the Vienna process, and this is where Kurtzer, by the way, Dan is also involved. He's been involved in behalf of the United States in some, what they call second track diplomacy, where he's been meeting with Russians and others about Syria. And that's sort of at a stalemate now because of Russian-U.S. relations having tightened up and gotten much worse in the last 6 months to a year, partly because of the election thing, but partly also because I think Russia felt that it had a capacity to do things in Syria to keep Assad in power, at least for now. And by the way, I mean, I think probably Assad is the last person on earth to believe that the Russians would eventually necessarily keep him in power. I mean, the Russians aren't loyal to Assad. Don't be mistaken. And in fact, there's a former foreign minister. This is an interesting part because Carol and I have met with him many times, a man named Farouk al-Sharaa, who came from Deraa, the area where the Arab Spring broke out in Syria. A year after it broke out, the foreign minister of Syria went to the president and said, there's no way that this is going to be resolved militarily. You have to be willing to make a compromise with the opposition. He then fled the country because Assad was not willing to hear anything like that. And guess where I believe he's living? He's in Russia. I think, best guess, he's not been heard from, but why would you want to have him heard from now? But he's in some ways a perfect candidate because he's a Baathist. He's highly respected in the Baath party circles. So if you're going to keep a government from totally falling apart when they make some kind of deal, you need someone to be able to come in who could play that role. So, I'm not predicting. I'm just saying, interesting possibility. Farouk al-Sharaa. I wouldn't be surprised. I didn't like him much, but I understood that he was a very important person in Syria, and it was interesting to meet with him, as we did a number of times. All right, and then we get down to the last one, and he says it very gingerly, but it's he's got a mouthful. Perhaps most importantly, but also most challenging, focus more resources and efforts on the underlying social and economic causal factors that promote instability, frustration, and radicalization, and which provide Daesh, ISIS, fertile ground to build support. And that's where you get back to the Arab Human Development Reports, and look at the problems in those societies. And if you know, there are people, one of the people that you can look up that I find very reliable is a man named Rami Khoury, K-H-O-U-R-I. He puts out a monthly column, and he's been writing about this for several years, which is the problems in Arab societies that unless and until they're addressed, the Arab societies are in big trouble. Big trouble. And he, as I say, produces a column about every month or so. So that, and he puts it, as I say, he puts it gingerly, but most importantly and most challenging. Why most challenging? Because where's the money going to come from? Where's the money going to come from, you know? It's obviously, I think it's money much more smartly or wisely spent than generally what we spend on the military. But the trouble is, the easiest thing to do about ISIS is to say, we're going to get them militarily. We're going to get them. And in some ways, we may be able to, quote, get some of them that way. But in the long haul, it's going to depend on societies that have a certain openness and resilience and healthiness and capacity to deal with different currents in order to undermine the growth of ISIS. Well, as I said, it's a ridiculous amount of ground to cover. If you got a little bit of new information or new insight about one country or another, I'll feel very pleased or feel satisfied that it was worth doing. And also, if I've stimulated you to do some readings, and I call your attention back to the bibliography, I put my copy of the bibliography, where is it? Here it is.
Just, you know, obviously I've divided the bibliography into the three sessions. Those two top books are just major textbook-like books about the history of the Middle East. And if you have an interest in a particular country, getting that one of those books out of the library would be worthwhile, and looking at a chapter or two about the country you're most interested in. They're reliable, they're credible, they're the kind of books that good university classes who are doing history of the Middle East would have, most likely would have one or both of them in their course. The third book down is old, but it's very interesting. This is a man that teaches at Johns Hopkins, Fuad Jami. The book is The Arab Predicament, and you see it's Arab Political Thought and Practice Since 1967. It's a very interesting book, and I'll just give you one quotation from it that I have almost taken as a guidepost in my life about the Middle East. He says, and he's talking about the Arabs. He's talking about the Arabs. But think about it as I did as soon as I read it, as it applies to the Jews. He says, it is easy to judge, but hard to understand the shadows that drive people. The things that make them do what they do. Even if we disagree with what they do, it's important for us to try to understand why they did it. And he's talking about Arabs. And I thought, oh wow, Palestinians, Syrians, whatever. But then I thought, but Jews?
Americans.
Well, good, I'm glad you obviously must be an American. No, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's great. It's, you know, I guess the reason, well, obviously he was writing about Arabs, he wasn't writing about Americans. We sometimes, about Arabs, and sometimes about Jews, sum them up and sort of understand why they did it. But maybe there's more to it. And I think you're right, there's also more to it here. I think we've got a huge challenge on our hand now with the division in our country. Well, how are you to define it? And how do you, there's an old rabbinic saying from about 300 AD, that the reason we're given two ears and one mouth is because we should listen twice as much as we talk. Well, I have violated that in spades this morning, but I'm available and around, and hopefully we'll see each other at meals and coffee and maybe on Wednesday. Thank you.